Jersey. Pottery of all nations. Okay. That was very nice. I got almost lyrical there for a minute. You know, it's a funny thing. When you look, I'm not being facetious here. When you look at what we really like, us, I mean people. When you look at what we really like, the things that really excite us. Now, it is true that many of us attempt to pretend that those things don't excite us. It is true that many of us pretend throughout, well, for one reason or another, inhibition, it doesn't make any difference. We pretend that we're not interested in large numbers of things that secretly do interest us. How many people do you know who aren't secretly interested in a giant traffic accident? Now it's hard to, it's, you know, you can say to me, well, not me, I go the other way. Oh, yes, but that doesn't mean you're not interested. You go the other way, and then you ask everybody as you go, what happened? You know, anybody killed? You know, well, yeah, really? You look, oh, wow, I'm going there. But the thing that is there, you know, it's obvious that you are interested. Now, can you think, just think for a second, just for a couple of seconds there maybe, of the things that you are interested in, that all of your life you have pretended that you're not. Just think, you're very carefully about this now. Yeah, that's right. Think very carefully now, and not only pretended that you didn't, but you wished that you weren't interested in them. Maybe that's even better. And you think, you see, that you are obviously inside decadent, you're rotten, because the good people aren't interested in those things. And since you're obviously striving to be a good people, whatever it is in your group that... And oh, by the way, one more thing has to be said, that being a good people is not necessarily, now don't assume that I'm talking about the squares, because if you're in the hip world, to be hip is, of course, to be one of the good people. And so there must be many things you don't like. Nothing is sadder than to see a hippie down on the Fiend John secretly sneaking a look at the sport page to find out what the Chicago White Sox did, you know. You know, sneaking it back there. Somebody says, hey, what are you... Oh, he's hurrying on his way to the theater section, you know. He's just rough on the way. He says, I thought I saw there was a review of George Scott. No, I see. It's the White Sox. Oh, I'm sorry. He keeps going. Now, there are many things which, on both sides of almost any fence, every one of us is... We're basic. We're what we are, you know. We're like just so many weevils. We are like so many ants. Now, we pretend we're not. We pretend that there is a great difference between all of us. But I have yet to find this to be true. I have yet to be shown that there is much difference at all between people. I've yet to be seen. Now, even between the hip and the square, between the in and the out, there is very little difference. Because everybody, no matter what he is, no matter where he is, thinks he is somehow in. And he is, literally, in the group that he's created around him. He is in. He is in with the Trimble Avenue Pinochle Playing Society. He is in. And he knows this, you see. He is in down at the Bolium. On Wednesday nights, he fits. He's right there on Alley 7, and by George, he's in. They know him there. The girl at the counter who sells the knee-high orange knows him. Hi, Chuck. And he says, ah, the regular, you know. And she knows what the regular is, you know. He's a cheapie. And so, you know, the being in is nobody thinks he's out. Now, some people think they're not as in as they should be. This is true. But nevertheless, they don't ever really think they're truly out. Rare cases. Now, the question comes up then about the things that make us really what we are. Now, let's face this, one thing we must face, that every last single one of us is not only capable of, but is a receptacle for hate of one kind or another. Now, you may hate in a good cause. This is an interesting bit that often happens. A guy says, what do you mean? Sure I hate. I hate haters. You know, and his eyeballs are sticking out, you know, his ears are sweating, and he'll tell you he hates haters, and he brings that knife out. And I'll say, but you are a loving person, aren't you, George? Yes, I'm Lord. Oh, I hate haters. His knife goes, and he's out after haters. That's his hate. And then of course you'll find another guy. Nobody ever thinks he hates. That's nobody has ever. I've never heard anybody define himself as a hater, and no matter how patently hating they are. I sat one night in a coffee shop with, of all people, George Lincoln Rockwell. And Lincoln he gets a hurt look on his face. He says, "Me hate me?" Of course, he said, "There are certain people that." And he goes on. Well, you know, it's scary to find that nobody thinks he hates, and yet there it is. Now, let us then admit something. Let us then admit that hate is a human characteristic. It's not a learned thing, particularly. It's not a thing that, sure, some people have it more than others. Just like stripes are a characteristic of zebras, some have darker stripes than others. But they all got them stripes. And they have, and under a certain light, even the ones that seem to be without stripes are even more striped than the ones that seem to be striped. So it's pretty hard to say. Now, let's take other things. Now, can you think of anything else that you have secretly been pretending you don't like? Not only don't like, now, of course, what happens? We have one little fascinating characteristic of us, our creature, this thing we are, is that whenever something breaks out, that we secretly would like to have all our life been involved in, we take a fantastic stand against it because somebody is doing the thing that we ourselves have suppressed or been mad about or angry about or tried to pretend it never was and so on. Now let's take this business of obscenity. I saw a little interesting case. A group of guys in a town not too far from here got very angry over what they called obscene movies. Now, what they were mad about is that they were playing them down at the local movie house. This same group, I happen to know, about a year before, were busted for stag films on a Saturday night smoker. Now, the same group. Now, of course, what they would call theirs, well, you know, we're just a bunch of the boys having a little fun on Saturday night. But do you realize that the women and the children, and they go on, you see, with this wonderful kind of rationalization, which they whip out when they get mad when everybody else is going in, looking at the same things, only very mild compared to what they had on a Saturday night. Well, this is a problem. Now, What in you, the little things inside of you? Everybody pretends then, another thing that we like to pretend is that we don't have the same instincts that other people do. We just don't. For example, we're a carnivore. And have you noticed that the most protesting of all eaters are the vegetarians? You don't hear meat eaters getting mad and forming meat eater unions. You don't hear them getting mad and writing editorials about the beauties of eating beefsteak because it's a natural quality of a carnivore. We just accept it. It's only when you try to fight a natural tendency that you become very loud and aggressive about the thing which you're fighting. So you say, "Oh, of course not. Why, there's nothing I like better than carrots. Why, I've lived on my right here, and I think carrots, right here, and cabbage, right here, bananas, right here, oh, peanut sauce, right here, and they go on, you see. And who's, you know, who are they trying to convert? Themselves. That's the problem. Themselves. So every time a guy who is a natural-born meat eater sits down with a bunch of people who are laying into the sirloin steak, and he's sitting there with his celery pâté, you know, he starts to say, "Why, you guys, don't you realize you're a liar? Why? No, you know, he's not going to convince anybody. They're all sitting there with the gravy running out of their ears, and that's it. Proselytizing, of course, of all kinds is pretty much the same. I've listened to dialectic arguments of really dyed-in-the-wool true believers. Communists, it doesn't make any difference what ist. Communist, capitalist, it doesn't make any difference which one of the particular ideologies. But a true doctrinaire, true believer is like one of these people with the celery. You'll hear them say, and of course, the simple laboring working man everywhere slaving under the yoke of capitalistic oppression, the warmongering imperialist capitalist slave owners. Everybody's sort of standing looking, you know. Who's he trying to convince? Guess who? And he figures, yes, right, and if he figures if he shouts loud enough and doesn't let anybody else say anything, it will be so. It will be so. And he gets very shrill at it. Have you ever seen a dedicated, a really dedicated, true capitalist dedicated guy? You know, the kind of guy that writes a letter to, Newsweek or Time or Life and says, yeah, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to undermine a capitalist situation? What are you trying to do about this? What about this poverty stuff you're talking about? Well, let me tell you, the capitalist situation says it's the survival of the fittest, you see? The guy that's most survival, the guy that's most equipped should make the dough, let the others sink or swim. We all sink or swim. Shut up, you capitalist, communist, man. And it goes on, you see. Well, who's he trying to convince, you see, as he's stashing it away in the bottom bureau drawer? Well, guess who? It's very, the more angry a person is about a certain ideology, the more he's trying to convince himself. And the less he will allow anybody else to open his trap. Because, you see, that's very hard to do then, that self-convincing job. The minute somebody says, yes, but what about? Take him out. That is not on the subject. Well, I'll never forget the most of the really dedicated true believers will never allow anyone else to discuss it with them. This is one of the, for example, it's very difficult to get an Ayn Randist to discuss it with them. They won't discuss. They only listen to lectures and question and answer periods that are all based and set up and the whole thing. So because anybody says, you know, well, what about your grandmother who died of the crud? I mean, somebody's got to take care of her. Why? What? You know, I don't want to hear that. Immoral. Yeah. Well, then they throw you out. You go out on the street, and it's the end of it. This is the mark of the true believer. And the more shrill people get about a specific point of ideology or philosophy or belief, the more you can suspect that they are very worried, very, very worried. And they know secretly that they're overlooking a large area of reality. They're somehow ignoring it, and they're dusting it under the old carpet there, you know, and they don't want anybody to say it. They don't want to, well, yeah, but what about that junk you put under the carpet there? What about that? And they throw them out. Because the human situation is truly, this is one of the reasons why there is that old myth of the Gordian knot. There is no untangling of it. And since there is no untangling of it, anybody who thinks he can untangle it is obviously overlooking one end of the string, or at least another end of the string, or at least five ends of the string. Who knows? He is overlooking these things, or he doesn't want to see them. That's perhaps the closest to it, because we all know, you see. We all know. Each, every one of us, being human beings, all know. We do. A lot of things we know, we don't want to say we know. And a lot of the things we know, we don't want to know we know. And a lot of the things we know, we don't want to admit we know. But we all know. We do. We know. And don't look up at me and say, what's this nut talking about? Well, that's all right. You're not fooling Daddy here. We do know, and you know, and I know. Now, we know we know a lot of things. And a lot of the things we know make our particular crusade very difficult to carry on. So we shut our eyes to those things. We just have to. If you're a segregationist, if you're a real wild-eyed segregationist, you just shut your eyes to lots of areas of reality. You just have to, if you're going to continue to do that. If you have another particular belief, and another thing I find too about the true believers is that they deal in one of the sneakiest of all things, the generality. And the generality is the thing which will finally just sink us. Now, the generality is fine if you're beginning a scientific thesis that will later prove a specific fact. But when you start using generalities as facts per se, then you're in trouble. And such words as freedom, boy, if that isn't a generality. Have you noticed that both sides of the great race issue use that word? Isn't that fascinating? It is a fact, and they both use it. Both sides use it. Such words as individual dignity, both sides use that. What does individual dignity mean? Very hard to say what it means. And all these words, these are the Greek generalities, and it's a difficult problem when you're faced with people who use the same language, and they're 180 degrees out of phase. The same words they use, 180 degrees out of phase. And even have the same kind of zealous evangelism for moral right. You ever hear this guy Wallace talk? Oh boy, he talks like he's an evangelist for a moral right, you know, a wild scene. And on the other hand, Malcolm X is the same way, you know. And they're both 180 degrees out of phase. It's wild. We must say this, that as human beings, all of us as human beings, I don't care what side of any issue you're on, there are great areas about yourself and about being a human being, about being this thing that walks around on 2 feet, has a couple of ear pans sticking out on the side there, and once in a while gnaws at carrots and occasionally whips off a piece of sirloin. This creature, whatever we are, this creature, there are large areas about all of us, each one of us within ourselves, that we care to and choose to and perhaps try to, as hard as we can, ignore, sweep under the table. We like to pretend. Another one of the things we like to do, too, is to pretend that one certain group within our society does not have these particular virtues or, let's say, non-virtues. This is always one of the great myths of mankind. We like to pretend that, say, that guy over there does not have hate in him. We like to pretend this. We like to pretend this. We like to pretend that maybe we like to pretend that other people have it and we don't have it. This is another kind of pretense which can lead to bloodshed, too. This kind of thing is of course it's as old as mankind. There's no question about it. And anything I say will make no difference because I'm here too. I'm one of them. I'm one of it. All of us. We're all here together. But nevertheless, one of the great myths is always drifting up, and that is, of course, we know too that this strange creature, man, has things which we consider evil. Well, I don't know whether this is considered evil in all of the scheme of nature. That's very hard to say. Is there such a thing as absolute evil? That's very difficult to say. You'll hear people, let's take the vegetarian, for example. People say that eating meat is a moral wrong. And yet, on the other hand, practically all the animals that he idealized eat meat. And they eat meat day and night, as much as they can lay their mitts on. And they will say, yes, but they are simple little creatures of the field and they don't know. Well, what do you mean they don't know? I mean, sure, you know. We sprang out of the same field, you know, the same grass and the same wind is howling through our ears. But nevertheless, we like to pretend, and this probably is the most dangerous of all things. We like to pretend a lot of things about this creature. One of the things we know is that he is also capable of strange concern for his fellow creature. This we know. Mankind does this. No matter who he is, he does this. He has a strange kind of compassion for his fellow walking around biped. It is not necessarily true that one lion has compassion for another lion. This has never been really isolated. In fact, many people who deal in these areas will tell you this is one of the great differences between mankind and the animal, that the animal does not give a hoot for his fellow kind. He just doesn't even really know his existence. And they say that that the only involvement he has is out of a basic instinct, say, a herd instinct or an instinct of procreation or something of that nature. Now, man, though, is capable of this strange thing. Not only capable, we all have it. Now, one of the great myths is to assign these virtues, if we want to call them that, to certain people and certain groups, usually ourselves. Generally, we will assign virtue to us, whoever we have. Now, I'm not talking about Americans. I'm talking about whatever group you happen to be in. Whatever group if you consider yourself a hippie, let's put it on that base, you assign good to the hippies, bad to the squares. If you're a segregationist, you assign good to the segregationists, evil communist dupes to the other side, whatever it might be. If you're a Negro or a color person, I'm sure that you must assign large amounts of good to your group and say there is less in the other group. You see this in plays. You see it all the time. On the other hand, if you're white, the tendency is to do the opposite. You assign good and so on up and down the line. This is one of the great sources of myth in our world. Always. It always is. You saw this in Nazi Germany. This became a mania in Germany in the 1930s when it became part of a governmental program where it was actually an established pattern of governmental behavior, and it became part of the structure of the society rather than a basic trait of individual men. By the way, one of the interesting things about laws is that laws generally tend, and it has been ever since about the time of the last true barbarian, maybe about the time of the rise of Greek culture, that laws have tended to militate in favor of the things which generally you don't want to do but are for the good of everyone. In short, laws have generally tended to be created, say, look, there's we have, let's all decide right here and now that even though you may have this hate thing in you, that we're for the good of everybody, let's say it's going to become illegal for you to holler out Charlie Brown is a Watanabe or whatever you want to do. In other words, these various libel laws, one thing or another. Now, that may be called intrusion on your freedom. Well, it is, in a way. There's no question about that. But you see, it also stops other guys from saying things to you. Remember that very well. We always like to think in terms of our freedom being truncated, but remember, it also cuts other guys who may not be as nice as you are, who may not be as sweet and loving and all beautiful as you might be. So when you set about to just per se burn down City Hall and get rid of the laws, be careful. You're opening up that proverbial Pandora's box, because one of the very first things that the Nazis had to do, you know, was to kill all the laws of the Weimar Republic. They literally threw out all those old outmoded laws. And they said, let's get a simple society. And then they put in their own. Well, we don't have to talk about what happened with the flamethrowers and all, like people yelling and hollering and throwing the grenades and stuff. But nevertheless, and may sound now to a lot of people that I am here advocating authority. I am not at all. I'm merely discussing why authority occasionally pops up. Now, not authority. Don't use the term authority. We confuse authority often with civilization. That's a big confusion. We like to say, you know, that's a key difference there. So when somebody says, he's a pro-authority. No. Civilization is an accepted code of behavior between human beings that enables the average human being to achieve the most out of his life. It's going to pull down some guys. It's going to push some guys up. But in general, this is why it came about. I'm not defending it. I'm merely describing it. Now, here you have a problem here, though, of course, with the pretenses that we all carry on. We also like to, this is another one of the myths, we also like to assign to whatever group that you're not for a great mythical, let's say, a great myth-creating tendency. In short, the guys who are on one side of, let's say, argument X will say the other side, of course, is living in a dream world. They're idealists. They're fuzzy-headed eggheads. They're dreamers, and they're just living in a myth world. Ridiculous. We're realists. We're realists. You'll find them saying that on both sides of situation X. The word realist, by the way, is one of the great canards, one of the great non-words of all time. You never hear me describe myself as a realist. No, sir. Because I think a realist, like a perfect lover, is only a concept. Has nothing whatsoever to do with, excuse the word, reality. Not at all. And I love to hear people get on and say, well, of course, I am a realist. I do not believe in... And then they come out with some insanely ridiculous, wild statement that is just... it's funny to find how many realists believe in Superman, which is the most unreal of all concepts. Unreal. I heard a lady being interviewed the other day, a famous lady author, who all of her books are based on an elite of beautiful people who are all wonderful, all knowing, who really are the true aristocracy, the elite, the Superman philosophy, in short. Say, I am a realist. Oh boy. And the search for the Superman has led people into more bloodbaths than any other single problem. That's, what do you think the last one was about? What do you think the one before that was about? What do you think the one with Alexander the Great was about? And it goes on and on and on, ad infinitum, ad nauseum, and will continue because of the great myth-creating capabilities that we all have. There's no single one of us that can get away from it. Now, it depends on how virulent your myth is as to whether or not you're going to wind up with the flamethrowers. And let us put it this way. All myths are virulent up to a certain point. When you begin to take your myth and impose it on other people's myths, that's when the explosions occur. The minute you start blowing the whistle on one guy with... Now, I'm not saying that... You see, what happens when the myth runs away, of course, when it runs literally rampant and becomes a neurosis, in fact, it becomes a psychosis, that is when you have passed the borderline of the slightly neurotic myth and he becomes the axe-wielding paranoiac. Big difference. But boy, is it a deadly difference. And it's a difference that is so subtle. It just happens like nobody knows quite when, at what point. That today's dreamer is tomorrow's neurotic, is the day after tomorrow's axe-wielding paranoiac murderer. It goes in that progression. It's a very a very sneaky thing, and nobody knows quite at what point the transition is made. Nobody quite knows. One day something happened. They blew the whistle. He was sitting at the card game. He rushed out, grabbed the axe, and proceeded to kill Aunt Minnie. And 17 guys were operating peanut stands on the block. Nobody knows. At what point did all the people who followed Hitler stop being idealists about Germany and become murderers? At what point were they dreamers, maybe 100 years before, you know, when they were just writing the great Wagnerian dramas? And then suddenly, we came with the gas ovens one day, and it became a very real thing. It is hard to know when that transition is made, and I'm not... It sounds like I'm against dreams here now, doesn't it? Oh, no. I'm against paranoid axe-wielding murderers. It's because I've seen in my own lifetime so many people progress through that, those stages. And people keep wondering, what happened to old Charlie? What happened to Charlie? And they're getting the axe, and people are lashing him. And they say, what happened? They keep thinking he's that wonderful, sweet dreamer they used to sit around in the coffee shop with and drink beer with and talk about how what a great, beautiful new world he's going to come out with. Boom! You get the cat of nine tails. Pow! And Charlie's giving it to you. You wonder what happened. Where did he change? Well, it takes a long time for us to realize there has been a change. Maybe we never do realize it until we get an axe on our head. Then we say Charlie's changed. As long as he's beating other people, usually we say, well, they asked for it. They walked into it. After all, what could he do? And then, boom, you get one behind the ear. Then you know he's a nut. Well, that's part of the dream, too.
This is WOR Radio, your station for news. Stay tuned.